Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to today's Cato Book Forum. I'm Clark Neely, Senior Vice President for Legal Studies here at Cato, and I am delighted to welcome my former Institute for Justice colleague, Anthony Sanders, who is head of IJ's Center for Judicial Engagement, and more importantly, for today's purposes, the author of a very exciting new book titled Baby Ninth Amendments, How Americans Embraced Unenumerated Rights and Why It Matters. Welcome, Anthony.
Thanks so much for having me on, Clark. It's delightful to be able to launch the book with Cato. As your old colleague Roger Pilon likes to brag, I was his first blue booker on the Cato Supreme Court review. So it's nice to come full circle here.
Good. Well, welcome back. And we would be, I think, remiss if we didn't dive right in. So let's do it. For those of us who are interested not only in sort of the theory of constitutional law, but also sort of the practice and the implementation of constitutional law, a really important issue is whether a given constitution, and of course we do have both a federal constitution, the constitution, but then every state has its own state constitution. But a key question is whether a given constitution does or does not protect rights that are not specifically listed in the text of the constitution. What we have to call, unfortunately, for want of a better term, a somewhat clumsy sounding term, unenumerated rights, simply meaning rights that are not specifically listed in the text of the constitution. Why don't we start with a sort of a brief discussion of why this is such an important and challenging question when it comes to constitutional law from a practical standpoint, from actually trying to implement a constitution to protect people's rights. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you bet, Clark. So there's a couple ways that I like to explain this problem that I argue in the book, these provisions called Baby Ninth Amendments solve. But there's other ways you could try and solve this problem. And the problem is you want to protect rights with your constitution, whether it's your federal constitution, your state constitution, but you realize that there's a lot of rights you could protect and you can't list them all. So for example, just think about, and I do this in the introduction of the book as a thought experiment. Think about all of the things that you do in a day. So some are very important, some are very mundane, but they're all rather important to you. So you get up at the time that you choose for yourself. You eat what you think is best for you, what you choose for yourself. You go to work, and that may be a job that you chose over other options that you might have had. You might do something like if you're a parent, put your child in a school. And that might be a school you chose over other options. And then you might do things such as garden. You might garden in your front yard. You might play basketball with some friends. There's a lot of choices you make in the course of a day. Now, what if there's a law that's passed that restricts those choices or even eliminates them? Such as an extreme example, the state of Oregon once passed a referendum to ban all private schools. That was then challenged in court. Why was it challenged in court? Because people have a sense that if you're going to restrict something like that, it violates my rights. And we have certain rights in the United States. And if the government violates them, you should be able to go to court to protect yourself. Now, the problem is with the list that I just gave of things you might do during your day is that if you look at the federal constitution or you look at your own state constitution, which is structured in a similar way in every state, and every state has its own Bill of Rights, like the federal Bill of Rights, you will notice that just about none of those activities that I listed is actually in your Bill of Rights, right? You got speech in there, you got religion, there's various protections for criminal procedure. There's some other rights in there, takings, but there's not the right to get up when you want, the right to garden, the right to earn a living is in very few state constitutions. So how do we protect these rights? Well, now put yourself in a different place. Put yourself in the shoes of you're at a state constitutional convention and you're helping write the Constitution. Pretty cool responsibility. And this has happened many, many times in U.S. history. We all know the story of 1787 when the founding fathers got together and they hashed out the U.S. Constitution and then they amended it a couple years later. Well, the same has happened in every state and some states numerous times, in fact. So you're at the state constitutional convention and you're redoing the Constitution and you're going to redo your own state Bill of Rights. And you want to be very protective of rights. And so you're on the committee, perhaps, that's writing this Bill of Rights. And so you put all the rights in there that we all know from the federal Constitution, speech, religion, cruel or unusual punishment. You put in rights that were in the old state constitution. And then maybe you look around at other neighboring states and put in some of those rights. There's all kinds of interesting rights in state bills of rights if you want to look around the country. And then you start soliciting ideas from people and they say, well, how about a right to this or a right to that? Right to garden, we should put that in there. A right to get up whenever you wish. And then you start thinking, wait, you know, if we put all of these rights in there, we're getting a pretty long list. And it dawns on you, as it should dawn on everyone, that if you're just talking about the exercise of your liberty, there are literally an infinite number of rights, because there's an infinite number of ways that we exercise our liberty and that we interact with each other. And so you say, well, look, we can't list everything. And so how do you get around that? You list some, that's going to imply that those are the only rights there are. But you can't list everything. And so Americans have come to a solution. This took a long time. It evolved over the course of US history. I think it was done early on with the federal constitution. Others may disagree. But what I think my book shows is that over time, Americans came up with a solution, which is at the end of a Bill of Rights, you just say, et cetera, et cetera. There are other rights that are just as important. We can't list them all, but they're also protected. And that's what this language from the Ninth Amendment to the US Constitution that is then put in most state constitutions does. It kind of tries to square the circle of protecting some rights, but also protecting others.
So a lot to get into there. And let me start by saying this. My experience is that people who don't like the idea of unenumerated rights, or at least they don't like the idea of judges protecting rights that are not specifically listed in the Constitution, often have a tendency to sort of kind of poo-poo those rights or minimize them or suggest, well, you know, it's just really economic rights. And I want to meet that head on and say that, you know, this is not hypothetical. I want to make sure people understand that. So, for example, in the early part of the 20th century, we began a horrible national obsession with eugenic sterilization. And at one time, two-thirds, I believe, or more than half at least, of all states had laws requiring eugenic sterilization. That was a case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court, the infamous Buck v. Bell case. Do you have an unenumerated right not to have your reproductive organs torn out by state-sanctioned eugenicists? Pretty important question, I would say. In more modern times, of course, the question has arisen whether you have a constitutional right, an unenumerated constitutional right, to access potentially life-saving drugs. There was a case called Abigail Alliance in the DC Circuit. It was a group of people that were terminally ill with cancer. They had exhausted all possible therapies and medications, but their doctors said, you know what, there's an unapproved drug that's going through FDA approval process that might save you. They challenged in court the FDA's withholding of that drug, and they were told by the DC Circuit, nope, that's an unenumerated right that we are not prepared to protect in any meaningful way. So I invite you to sort of comment, if you'd like to, on this idea that there's not really that much at stake here in terms of protecting unenumerated rights, because they're just trivial things like what time you get up or whether you can wear a hat, you know, whether you can have a garden in your front yard. And maybe that means, you know, a lot to you, but like your life doesn't really depend on any of those things. So respond to that, if you would.
Sure. Yeah. So starting at the beginning, do we have an unenumerated right to those things that you just identified, such as bodily saving drugs, life-saving drugs? You have to ask, what does the Constitution say? So there are some libertarians who might argue, I don't care what the Bill of Rights say, these are rights that we just have are protected, and our judiciary should be enforcing them. And I get that argument. And I'm not saying that argument isn't right, but I think the way that courts are comfortable adjudicating these things, and the way that people usually think about these matters when they write constitutions, is to say, well, what does the Constitution say? And because Americans like a broad protection of rights, we have written our constitutions to do just that. And so we don't have to worry about, you know, this is just a natural right that should be protected no matter what. It's actually there in the Constitution. Why is it there in the Constitution? Because precisely what you were just talking about, Clark, to say the right to bodily integrity, or the right to try to take medicine from a doctor who's willing to provide it to you, to try to save your own life. Those are just basic natural rights that are pretty obvious that we should have in some way and have some measure of protection for. And therefore, it's no surprise that if you look at our state and federal constitutions, that those kinds of broad protections are in there. And they're in there because constitution writers have done this two-step where we identify a lot of rights. We know we can't identify them all. And so then we have some language that does that. So maybe some of the listeners will be like, okay, well, what is this language that you're talking about? So the Ninth Amendment, many of you may know, which is often called the stepchild of the Constitution because it's so often been ignored by the federal courts. It says the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. That language is put in there, was drafted in 1789 and then adopted in 1791 in the federal Constitution. And there are many people who argue, well, that doesn't actually mean what it says. It doesn't actually protect your right to bodily integrity or what have you, because it's really about federalism, or it's really about a status quo when the Constitution was ratified for not infringing on the state's rights or what have you. I don't think those are correct arguments. I go with the argument made by a Cato scholar, Randy Barnett, that these actually means what it says and protects rights beyond just those. But what do you do then when you have that language in a state constitution where there's no federalism, right? There's that, you don't have the same history of the interplay of the 10th Amendment and all these other arguments that we don't need to worry about today. You just have it in a state constitution. It says other rights retained by the people. The most important thing to do there is to look at the word retain. I spent a lot of time in the book worrying about what this word retained is. What retained is doing is speaking to this idea of a social contract. Now, social contract isn't a real thing. It didn't actually happen from the state of nature going into society, as social contract theorists have talked about, and some of you probably remember from philosophy class or what have you. But it's a way to think about how we share how we balance our rights and the powers of government. So the idea is we have certain rights that are we have as individual people. Then we come together in society, we give up some of those rights, we do give up some of those rights to government, but we retain others. Now, what's a right that we would retain that we don't really need to have a functioning society where we can have a government that protects our rights, provides some public goods, but otherwise we get to keep the other rights? Well, I think the ones you just identified are pretty obvious. Your right to bodily integrity. Just because it's not specifically listed elsewhere in the Bill of Rights does not mean, say, the government has a right to come and sterilize me or take a body part or do something else horrendous to my person. That is protected as a retained right. And then we can argue about, well, where is that line and where's the government's legitimate interest in regulating some of these rights? That's a different argument. But the fact that the right is there and that it is specifically protected by the Constitution through this open-ended language is not that hard to fathom. And one thing I really hope people take from the book, whether they agree with all the minutiae of what I talk about, is that this was not a weird way to think about how we would structure a constitution, that we would have this problem of listing some rights and then not wanting others to be implied, and having rights come up in the future that we haven't even thought about, right? Who was thinking about sterilization, say, when a state structured its constitution decades before the progressive era that you were just discussing? And so we have this language that can be applied in the future when we come to new situations that are going to present new challenges, and we can think about what those rights are that are retained that are nevertheless protected by the Constitution.
The points that you make in the book is that there's a real tension between the seemingly clear language that appears in the constitutions of about two-thirds of the states, the baby Ninth Amendments, that have some, somewhat similar wording of the federal Ninth Amendment, but that in one way or another express the idea that we all retain these unenumerated constitutional rights. There's a tension between the clarity of that language and the serial, although not unremitting, failure of the judiciary to implement that language, to enforce. Now, you have some examples, a handful of examples of courts enforcing baby Ninth Amendments. We'll get to that in just a second. But let's sort of preview this by giving you a chance to kind of explain for the listeners, why is there this disconnect? You've got this fairly clear language. I think you make a very powerful case that the language is in fact clear. And again, because this et cetera language, as you describe it, appears in a state constitution, we don't have some of these arguments that have been deployed against giving the Ninth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution any substance. You know, it's a federalism provision, or it's, you know, some other, sort of hortatory formulation. This is in the language of a state constitution, and it gives fairly clear instructions, one would think, to the judiciary to enforce rights that are not specifically enumerated in the Constitution. Tell us, first explain in your own words whether it's accurate to say that state courts, in your view, have been insufficiently dutiful in implementing that language, and if so, why?
Sure. I wish I had more of an answer to why, but I'll do my best to answer you. So state courts over the years have done a lot of what federal courts have done. In fact, your book, Clark, Terms of Engagement, about the failures of the federal judiciary to do a lot of these things, a lot of that could apply in many states to state courts. So state courts have been serious with their constitution at times over the years. They've identified, not just in baby Ninth Amendments, but other provisions of their state bills of rights, and tried to protect rights with that language and taken that language seriously. But like the federal courts, they have often looked the other way and put a thumb on the scale of the side of government when the government is violating people's rights. So there's kind of a bit of a too cute answer to some extent to your questions, which is that state judges, just like federal judges at times, have not been engaged with either the text of the state constitution or with the facts and the matter before them. Now, there's a few other things going on here, though. And one is that a lot of the times when state courts have enforced unenumerated rights over the years, whether we're talking about the right to contract, which was, just like at the federal level, more enforced, say, in the early 20th century than it is today, or more personal rights, such as some privacy rights, which also are a little bit more enforced, say, the last 50, 60 years, just like at the federal level, that has often been done with the same tools that the federal courts have used, which is the idea of substantive due process, usually based on an actual due process clause, sometimes not, though, and other similar provisions like that in state constitutions. And sometimes you get courts that, you know, don't even worry about the text of the Constitution at all, that just say, this is just not right, we're going to say it's unconstitutional. So I think some of it is following the errors of the federal judiciary, even if they're errors that maybe we can be sympathetic for. Now, I think that the idea of substantive due process is grounded in history, grounded in the text, is something legitimate that courts do. But compared to alternatives, it can be a little clunky, right? We often argue, and Clark, you've argued much more than I have, that in the 14th Amendment, the Privileges or Immunities Clause would do much better work at protecting unenumerated rights than the way that the idea of substantive due process has been used. The same can be said in state courts. Now, there are occasional examples, as you said, that this breaks through, and you use the and language that's more suited to protecting unenumerated rights is used than state due process clauses, for example. And I think some of that, as I said, is the state courts following federal courts. But I think some of it at times, and more recently we could say too, some of it we should put a little bit of the onus on the lawyers. And that lawyers, when they're representing a client, they are being in many ways conservative, because that's the way law works incrementally. And so they're raising these cases and they're relying on, say, substantive due process precedents, because they've been raised in the future. And I get that. But I think that if we peek ahead to the future for a moment, I think that could be changing a bit. And I see signs of this in some state courts recently, with the whole reattention to text and rediscovery of text, but the whole textualist revolution, Justice Scalia and all of that movement. Most people think about that in terms of statutory interpretation and the federal constitution, but there have been more serious attempts, and it's not just a conservative thing, with more progressive judges too, of paying closer attention to the text of state constitutions. I think when they do that, not just baby Ninth Amendments, but other provisions in state constitutions that are protecting rights are taken a bit more seriously. And so I have some hope for the future that this is going to change. But yeah, why the last 200 years of baby Ninth Amendments being out there and not being used as much as they could be? I think it's largely this judicial abdication to some extent, but also a bit of the dead hand of the past.
Pick up the pace a little bit and turn this into a little bit more of sort of a back and forth, and it's gonna feel a little bit like a cross-examination, but it won't be a hostile one. I want us to posit an appropriately engaged state court judge, perhaps a state Supreme Court justice, who's really trying to get this right. Let's say this person basically is sympathetic to the points that you've been making, and feels committed to fully enforcing all of the provisions of the state constitution, including the baby Ninth Amendment. One of the stories that you relate in your book is an actual IJ case where the Institute for Justice represented a couple in Florida that grew vegetables in the front yard of their house. Now, as I recall, the city ordinance said you can grow vegetables in the back, that's fine, but you can't grow vegetables in the front. But in their case, I believe they had some trees in the back. It was shady. It's not a good place to grow vegetables. So they did it in front. And they were told that they had to tear out that vegetable garden, or face some kind of ruinous fine. And they challenged that law and asserted a constitutional right to grow vegetables in the front of the house. Is that all accurate so far?
Yes. One additional detail the viewers might be interested in is they could grow fruit and flowers in the front yard. They just could not grow vegetables.
Interesting. Okay. So the government's argument, as I recall, and I think you say this in the book, was largely aesthetic. It's not a health and safety issue. It's basically just we want the neighborhood to look neat, and letting people grow vegetables in the front yard doesn't look neat, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. So then, let's work through this and do some hypotheticals. So you're allowed to grow fruit. What if they grew, I don't know if you've ever encountered a durian, but it's a tropical fruit that is notoriously stinky, right? So now imagine that they're growing durians and some of them are rotting on the ground. And it's not just that the yard doesn't look neat. It smells awful. I've encountered a durian. I don't like the way they smell. Most people don't. You're not allowed to bring them into a hotel in some parts of Southeast Asia. And one of the best descriptions I've ever heard is somebody describe it as it smells like sugary trash. Would you nevertheless, so now I'm a state Supreme Court justice trying to work through this case. Do you have an unenumerated right to grow stinky fruit in your front yard? Or is that a legitimate exercise of government power to say, you know what, that's just too much. If it was an apple, that'd be one thing, but this is a stinky durian, everybody's choking.
Well, I think you gave me a little bit of a loaded question there when you said it's a stinky fruit, right? So you definitely have a right to do what you want with your property, including growing a fruit on it. But then there's a line there. There's a line between people's rights all the time. And that's why we have government in the first place. And that's, if it's stinky, well, is it causing what we common law lawyers call a nuisance? So if it's creating a nuisance for your neighbor, and you know, just like you might with a pile of garbage in front of your house or a compost heap that you're not properly caring for, well, then that has a effect on your neighbors in a way that would be violating their rights. So if the ordinance says, you know, no stinky fruit, and you get into an argument over whether it's a stinky fruit or not, I think that's probably a fine ordinance because it's about a nuisance. But if it's just you can't have fruit, well, then we're going to have to look at the facts.
I'm going to pursue this because I think this is really where the rubber hits the road. It seems like it's chopping it pretty fine to say that an unkempt vegetable garden that is visually unappealing is well within your unenumerated rights. And even if people really hate the aesthetic, that's not a nuisance because it's just visual clutter and visually unappealing. But if it's olfactory, then, oh, that's different. Now it's a nuisance. And I'm not mocking the position. And it may well be that common law makes a sufficiently clear distinction. But does that strike you as a powerful distinction that, you know, somebody asserting the right to keep an unkempt, you know, sort of visually ugly vegetable garden in their front yard is on really firm footing, but somebody who wants to grow an unpleasant smelling vegetable or fruit, well, they're out of luck because common law says that's a nuisance.
I think that there's definitely a difference between those two, but I think the fact that we're having a conversation about that difference and about what the nitty gritty means between the two means that we're in a different territory than the Florida courts were when they examined that lawsuit. So in that lawsuit, we made the argument, our colleague Ari Bargill made the argument that there is a right to grow vegetables in your front lawn and this ordinance is violating it. And what the court could have done there is said, okay, you have this right. You do have this right. But we are now going to examine if the government, in its pursuit of the public good, can override that right or can regulate it in this way based on the facts of whatever it may be, based on the facts of the neighborhood, your lawn, and the government's interest in protecting that visual blight of whatever it is in your lawn. Now, we're going to disagree about whether visual blight, you know, is anywhere close to a stinky fruit. I don't think it is. I don't think most people would agree with that. But the fact that we're having that conversation means we're doing what courts do when they do real adjudication about rights, such as when it comes to free speech, when it comes to freedom of religion, when it comes to a lot of types of equal protection. They're making those questions. They're looking at the facts. And we were going to have a result that maybe some of us are going to disagree with, but we think that the Constitution was given its due. That's not what happened in that case when the court really just rubber stamped what the government did because it did not take that right seriously. And that's generally not what happens when it comes to unenumerated rights. So I hope that wasn't a bit of a non-answer, but I think it maybe it shows the viewers the difference between the taking the right seriously and perhaps the property owner still losing, and then saying the right really doesn't exist at all.
No, I think that is an important distinction, and it you know, it's, I think it's a consistent thread throughout the book. I want to make it, I don't know if it's going to make it harder or not, but I want to make it at least more realistic, right? Because it's not as if there's lots of people who'd like to grow durians, you know, in their yard and can't, but there are lots of people who'd like to grow marijuana on their property, and that is absolutely forbidden under the federal constitution. I'm sorry, under federal law, but also in, you know, still in some states. So let's put the federal law aside for one moment. What about a state that has not yet legalized the cultivation or possession of marijuana, and somebody wants to grow some on their yard? Maybe we, you know, a classic IJ client, right? So very sympathetic. Maybe it's somebody who's been in combat and is wants to use personally cultivated marijuana to treat their PTSD, or they have seizures, whatever. You know, they've got a, I don't think they need a sympathetic reason, but let's say they have one, right? Just to make them an extra good plaintiff. Work through that for us, if you would. I mean, is the right to grow an intoxicating plant that has been criminalized under federal law, or at least, you know, regulated and then criminalized for nearly a century, is that credibly among our unenumerated rights that would be protected by that state's baby Ninth Amendment, in your view?
Well, I would think similar analysis. First question is, what is the right that you're talking about? Most basically, the right you have is right to grow stuff. Well, absolutely, you have a right to that. As long as you own the property, you're not bothering anyone else with the growing, you can grow that. Now, is there some other reason? Now, say I was growing a plant that just by its nature gave off so much pollen, that an unnatural kind of pollen that wasn't prevalent in the area, and it made everybody around me automatically go into some severe hay fever. And the city came and said, you know, we just can't allow that kind of plant to be growing in our neighborhood because it's just not, it's not safe. Maybe if you had 40 acres, it'd be okay, but on your suburban plot, it's just not gonna be allowed. The city would have a good argument there that is a necessary or a permissible regulation of that right. When it comes to marijuana, things get a little bit harder, right? Because that's not what's happening. It's that I'm going to cultivate it, and then we have to get into whether I'm selling it, I'm doing it for my, I'm having it for myself. Is it okay for the state to just prohibit everyone in that state from taking that substance, as you might make the argument for or more dangerous kinds of drugs? Not that I'm agreeing with that. I'm just saying it would be a different analysis than marijuana. But that is how the court would look at that. So it wouldn't say, as a court generally would say today, well, sorry, there's no history and tradition for growing marijuana, even though, of course, there is. And so, therefore, you get rational basis review. And if the state thinks it's bad, then it can ban it. End of story.
Yeah, so... one of the things that has emerged in this discussion is also, I think, very much a theme in your book, is that even if one can credibly assert a right to do something that should be protected by a fair reading of let's say, your state's baby Ninth Amendment, that if the government has a sufficiently strong justification, it may be that they can overcome that right, whether it's growing vegetables or stinky fruit or potentially impairing, intoxicant. I was a little bit surprised to see something in the book, and I'm not, this is not a criticism. I really want to engage with you on the discussion. There was a passage, let's see, on page 118, where you say that that presumptively there would be a right to birth control, but that the government might be able to forbid you from taking a particular kind of birth control that was dangerous. Now, that is a pure paternalism argument, as I understand it. A lot of libertarians are going to have a real problem with any kind of a paternalism-based argument, because then you start asking questions like, okay, can they forbid me from riding a motorcycle? Because that's way more dangerous than driving a car. Can they forbid me from going scuba diving? Because that's a relatively hazardous pastime, et cetera. You get the point. So to kind of crystallize this as a question, do baby Ninth Amendments help us to better understand what kinds of justifications may be permissible for a government to assert and which ones are not? And let's start with paternalism. Do you stand by that remark, for example, in the book, that if a form of birth control were sufficiently hazardous, that the government would then be able to overcome somebody's unenumerated right to contraception?
What I'm getting at with that example is that just like in this case of, say, free speech or religion, which are enumerated rights, that when the government is regulating one of these unenumerated rights, that there could be an argument like that that could overcome your desire to exercise that right. So paternalism, not something I addressed on its merits in the book. Do I think paternalism on its own is a legitimate governmental interest? I tend to think not. I think there could be, you could make an argument that the government can do something that is purely to protect you, even if it is not going to harm everybody else, for, you know, in certain situations. I wouldn't leave that out. But the main point of that passage in talking about an unenumerated right is if it can do, it is, let's think about that government interest and the same way we think about overcoming an enumerated right, whether it's right to keep and bear arms, right to free speech, right? There are other rights that are enumerated in federal and state constitutions. So how we do that balancing, how we think about that, I think would be, a lot of it would be about this balance between the rights that we retain and the rights that we give up for legitimate governmental functions. Now, those are some hard questions, definitely some hard questions, some hard lines to draw. But we have a lot of those hard questions when we talk about enumerated rights. And we're happy that we have those. It's like, it's a good problem to have, right? That we're having rights protected, and yet we still need to draw the line somewhere. And so we need to balance those when we pass our laws and when we adjudicate our laws. But the same is going to be true when we're talking about an unenumerated right, like the right to use birth control.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're sort of at the heart of the issue here, right? Because, you know, if we're going to be fair-minded, I think we have to acknowledge that, you know, the government has legitimate interests. I know this comes up, for example, in the Second Amendment area. As you know, I helped litigate the Heller case, and an issue that the courts are eventually going to have to resolve is, does arms mean like literally any kind of a lethal weapon, up to and including tactical nuclear weapons? Is there a personal right to possess those? And if not, why not? And where do we draw that line? Earlier in the book, you cite as one of the handful of courts that actually applied a baby ninth in a protective way, the North Carolina Supreme Court in a 1908 decision held that the state's baby ninth protects the right of a person to import, to bring alcohol into a dry county to their own home for personal use. Did I get that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, so this is interesting, I think, because, you know, as I'm a fan of that particular intoxicant myself, but at the same time, I think we have to acknowledge that it is, throughout human history, it's a pretty destructive intoxicant. Somewhere between 80 and 100,000 people die in the United States every year through alcohol-related diseases and accidents. It seems to engender a significant amount of violence and bad judgment. Of course, we've reduced the number of drunken driving deaths, but that still happens. So what do we say to a community that just says, look, this is a powerful intoxicant with a really bad record, and we just want to live in a community where we don't have to be exposed to people who've been impaired by this notoriously, sometimes, you know, sort of, or potentially dangerous intoxicant? That's what we've chosen for ourselves. And now the courts are going to step in and say, no, this person has a right to possess and consume this intoxicant that is, you know, associated with a fair amount of dysfunctional behavior throughout history. Did the North Carolina Supreme Court, in your judgment, get this right? In other words, that the baby Ninth Amendment of the North Carolina Constitution is best read as protecting a right of personal access to alcohol, notwithstanding an effort by a Democratic majority to just say, no, not in this county. Respond.
Yeah. So in that case, gets a little complicated, unfortunately, but in that case, I think they did come to the right result. it might not be true in other cases. It might not be true in other state constitutions, and there's a little bit of balancing there. Hopefully I can talk about it in a moment. But in that case, so liquor was allowed for certain reasons in the county. It was allowed for under a gallon in the county for personal use. You could bring in under a gallon for your own personal use. But you couldn't make liquor there and you couldn't sell liquor there. And the defendant, he had, I think it was a gallon and a half is what he was prosecuted for. There was no evidence he was going to be selling it to anyone. It was simply for him and his own family. If he had brought it to a drugstore, then that would have been okay because you could have liquor for medicinal or reasons. And so the court said, you know what? He has this inherent right to have this liquor and to imbibe it if he wishes for his own use. And you're not overcoming that here. And part of the reason you're not overcoming that is like, you're not really that serious about this particular instance before the fact that if he had just had half a gallon less, he would have been perfectly fine. Now you could imagine, of course, a different scenario where there weren't those mitigating factors about how serious the government was. And so then you might look further into what the actual interest was and of either the person or the government. I would say that I think there are definitely all the mitigating factors you're talking about there are all the deleterious factors you're talking about when it comes to alcohol is definitely different than other substances that we put into our body. So there's going to be an analysis that waits a little further on the side of the government than say if it was just banning margarine, which is another example that comes up in some of these cases. I think the end result of that would probably be that nevertheless, it would a total ban like that would be unconstitutional. But I will add something, and that's that I'm talking about the text of these baby Ninth Amendments that have been adopted in a number of states. A lot of those states at one time had other parts of their constitution that said we're a dry state. So that obviously is accepting out of the whole retained methodology about what rights are protected that nevertheless, we are not protecting that right. And therefore you wouldn't interpret, now maybe I disagree with that on policy grounds, but you would not interpret that constitution in that way. And I think that demonstrates that there's some play in the joints there where if states did have that kind of a viewpoint about alcohol, they could do something about it. We don't have to be beholden to one particular provision of a constitution.
Let's stay in the vicinity of this topic. I want to work in a reader, one of our listener questions, and that is, how should baby Ninth Amendments help shape the way we think about the morals ahead of the police power? So let's take another example, not too far afield from alcohol in terms of our history of regulation. Would a state's baby Ninth Amendment protect, for example, an individual right to participate in prostitution or gambling? These are two activities that have been historically regulated both by state and federal governments and that lots of people wish to participate in. And some people would even argue they have a right to participate in and have argued that they have a right to participate in. What would a baby Ninth Amendment help us have a clearer understanding of how to go about adjudicating such a claim?
Well, would definitely have a clear understanding that those activities you're trying to participate in that by definition are going to be voluntary, right? Whether you're talking about gambling or prostitution on both sides, that you are going to look at it as something that is a right. So the question is it a retained right? Is it not, is it okay? Or is the government constitutionally forbidden from whatever the regulation they are doing, whether it's outright banning it or having a cap on the amount you can gamble or what have you. And part of that would be understanding that there are certain deleterious consequences that come out of say, gambling that doesn't come out of just people getting together to play cards where there's no money involved, or prostitution that doesn't come up, and you know, all the understandable societal impacts that happen from prostitution that don't happen when you just have normal consensual sex. Now, on the other side of that, right, there's what are the effects of the government doing these prohibitions? Like Cato, Cato sponsors know about all the deleterious effects of the war on drugs, right? Does it actually make it worse? Some of those issues would have to be put into the analysis about, like, is it really going to be better off if we have this prohibition, because you're just going to have these other problems over here. That's all part of the analysis. I know, I bet some people are wondering at this point, you know, are you going to be you want judges to do all this with strict scrutiny, which is, you know, what lawyers talk about when we adjudicate rights, where the government needs almost impossible odds to show that it's constitutional, because they have to show that there's no other way of addressing these problems? Or is it going to be some lower level of scrutiny? And my probably unsatisfactory answer is it doesn't really need to be any particular level of scrutiny, as long as it's being faithful to the text of these provisions, if it's done the same way we do enumerated rights. And also, if it's not a what you often call dog ate my homework level of scrutiny, where it's the federal rational basis test, where there's really no analysis of all these issues that I was just talking about, that of course are important when we're talking about the trade-off between the rights and the government's interest in regulating.
Yeah, it's funny when you talk about standards of review. I know when I was out talking about my book, and you know, certainly both of us in talking about the work that we do as libertarian constitutional lawyers, people obsess over this. Oh, are you calling for strict scrutiny and across the board? And you know, my response, and it sounds a little flippant or maybe a little tongue in cheek, but it's really not, is, you know, I don't get too hung up on that, because in my experience, what it really comes down to is, does the government have to give an honest answer supported by any credible evidence? And if the answer is yes, half the time they'll just give up. Because like, there really isn't anything legitimate going on. They weren't really trying to license who can braid hair because there's some, you know, somebody could get their hair yanked out or an infection. They were just trying to put people out of work. So if they have to give an honest explanation in court about, you know, what they're really trying to accomplish that regulation, they're just going to give up and go home. So you know, let's not get too hung up on standard of review. But I wanted to go back to something we discussed and work in a question from our friend Mike Dominguez, who submits this question via Twitter, which I think is quite profound and important that we address it. And I'll kind of try and tee it up in the way that I have in a somewhat concrete setting. So Mike asks, can you elaborate on the idea that our Constitution doesn't grant rights, but instead recognizes those, you know, so that, you know, Thomas Jefferson and others said we have certain unalienable rights. That means we couldn't give them up even if we wanted to. And I'm a little bit troubled, and I don't want to say troubled, but I sort of, my radar, my hair went up on the back of my neck a little bit when you pointed out that, well, if a state constitution has something in it that says, well, there can be dry counties in this state, or, you know, we have some history of prohibiting consumption or possession of alcohol, then maybe that's okay and not protected by the Ninth Amendment. Well, doesn't that really undermine the whole concept of unenumerated rights if it's really just contingent on, has the government sufficiently clearly expressed its intent to infringe this right in some document like a constitution? If so, well, then it goes out the window. And Mike's point, as I understand it, is, well, but no, aren't there, isn't that a weird concept of a right that it's sort of granted or withheld by the government at its, you know, sort of discretion, versus the idea, maybe there is an unenumerated, unalienable right to just put certain things inside your body, and it doesn't really matter what the state has said, you know, or purported to say about claiming the authority to interdict that. It's a lot to unpack. I can see you nodding along, so I hope that you get it. But let's talk about this. You know, do baby Ninth Amendments protect contingent rights, or do they protect unalienable rights, or could it be a mixture of both?
And sorry for the quick question. What do you mean by contingent rights?
Well, I would say a contingent right would be one like you described in conjunction with alcohol, that yes, you might have a right to possess and consume it, but if the state has been sufficiently clear about abridging that right in a state constitution, let's say purporting to authorize the establishment of dry counties where no alcohol is permitted, mm-hmm. then maybe you wouldn't have that right. To me, that's a contingent right. Versus an unalienable right is one that the government just simply has no power to take away.
Sure. So a state constitution could protect unalienable rights. And in fact, there are many provisions in state constitutions that do exactly that. Steve Calabresi has written about them, and they're called Lockean natural rights guarantees. They usually say unalienable rights. So often when state constitutions are written, they're protecting rights in all different ways. Your description just then of unalienable rights, so a right that you can't give up and can't be regulated, is not what the Ninth Amendments protect. We'll just say what the Ninth Amendment language protects. And that's because of how it's written. So I apologize if I'll get to that, the question that was asked on Twitter in a moment, but I apologize a bit that maybe I'm being a little positivist here, that I'm talking about exactly what the text says and not just, you know, our natural rights, damn it, that the government can't take away. But there's more than one way to think about those rights that are not granted by government. I definitely agree with that, but that we are trying to protect in some way. So you could just say, I have an unalienable right, and I don't care what you write in the Constitution, you can't take that away from me. That is a fine argument to make that I in many ways agree with, but probably it's not going to work that well in a court of law. I'll just give that warning out there. And two, when constitutions are written, they're obviously trying to protect rights in a way that's different than that. I mean, they're writing it out. Now, when you get, you'll learn a little bit in the book, in the history section I have in the book, that when some of these provisions were being written in state constitutional conventions, and that the first one was written in, was taken from the Ninth Amendment, put in the state constitution in 1819, all the way till 1970 is the most recent one in Illinois. When they were written, some people would object and say, we don't need this language of the Ninth Amendment in here because everyone knows those other rights are protected, right? So it's kind of like the argument with the Ninth Amendment itself. We have, you know, speech, religion, we have these other ones we've listed, but everyone knows the others are protected too. And the response would be, you know, have you seen the government in action? Maybe we'd like, a belt with this pair of suspenders to have a little bit more protection. And so they put in this language of Baby Ninth Amendment. So then we have, if we're talking about the Baby Ninth Amendment, just like if we're talking about the Due Process Clause or whatever it is, we need to worry about what it says. These people spend a lot of time, even though it was a long time ago, worrying about every jot and tittle of what it says. So we look at what it says, and it's talking about retained rights, which brings in this whole idea of the social contract and giving up some rights, but retaining others. So you could have an argument about, a more kind of robust right about that you can't be given up or regulated by government at all. But that, I think, would be a bit different angle to come at that issue than talking about these provisions, because you could slice up the rights that are retained and say there are these rights that you absolutely cannot infringe upon, you know, even if the public good requires it. And then there are the other rights that you can. But I don't think that's what's going on there. I think they're just talking about protecting our natural liberty and our property rights and recognize that there's some give and take because there's this whole idea of coming into society that's in the background.
Okay, well, I want to give you time to sort of give us a closing argument, but I'm going to end. I've been throwing you some fastballs, and I want to throw a slow pitch right over the fat part of the plate so you can take it out of the park and end on a note of confidence. But it's also an important question that one of our listeners has asked. And there's a premise here that I think you and I will not accept. So I'll just preview it that way. How can the Ninth Amendment be considered an et cetera clause when at the time the amendment was ratified, the authority of the Supreme Court to declare laws unconstitutional wasn't clear? So step up, take that one out of the park.
Okay. All right. Judicial review. And this this is great because part of my book that I add to that I had most fun with writing when I put the actual book together is some of this early ideas about judicial review and how they then interacted with the U.S. constitutions and then state constitutions. So there is a myth out there that I talk about that isn't really thought of as a reality by serious scholars issue or people who have researched these issues, but general public review in Marbury versus Madison. Actually, the idea of judicial review goes back to the founding. Why is that? Because before the American Revolution, there were in the British system no written constitutions. So how could you go in the court and say, well, this law is unconstitutional when there's no constitution that you're talking about? Once Americans started writing constitutions, whether it's the state constitution or then the US constitution, people started realizing, well, you're going to go in the court and you're going to have this higher law that's called the Constitution. And then you're going to have these lower laws like statutes, city ordinances, what have you. How do they interact? And the judges would say, well, it's the higher law. How can I enforce this lower law when the two contradict each other? And there's examples from before the Constitutional Convention itself of state courts doing just that. And when the Constitution was put together, I mean, Hamilton himself said in the Federalist that courts of law are going to police that the what the Congress does because of what the Constitution says. And so the Ninth Amendment was written with this backdrop in mind. Now, what one thing I'll say to listeners is that even if you don't buy this, even if you say, yeah, you know what, the Ninth Amendment, it's not about individual rights. I don't think that unenumerated rights are protected by the federal constitution. Even if you believe that, and I don't, if you read my book, I hope I convince you that in state courts, in state constitutions, when they took this language and put it in their own state constitutions, years after the adoption of the Ninth Amendment, that they do exactly that. And so I could see some fair-minded person coming away from this book saying, yeah, I'm still not sold on unenumerated rights in federal court, but I think they are a real thing under state constitutions. I know the federal government's big, bad, does all kinds of things. I get that. But when you're talking about state and local legislation, you have just as much a chance of having a law declared unconstitutional under your state constitution as you do under the federal constitution. And so if you're able to have your unenumerated rights protected when it comes to local or federal or local or state government, why not use that method instead of using the federal constitution? And so I hope that people understand that they take away from that, and that in the future, in state court, we have more protection of our unenumerated rights.
And we had a little bit of a technical issue when you began your answer to the question. So let me just quickly try to summarize it and make sure that I got it right. I believe you take the position, and I agree with it, that the idea that somehow judicial review was invented out of whole cloth by the Supreme Court in Marbury versus Madison in whatever that was, 1805 or 1806, and wasn't a part of either our system or the Anglo system before that, it's just a misconception, correct?
Exactly. That's absolutely right. So judicial review of a higher law like the Constitution didn't really exist before the American Revolution because they didn't have a higher law in Britain. They just had Parliament as sovereign. There were some ideas about this, but it wasn't really formed. But when we started writing constitutions from the get-go, state or federal, it's kind of an obvious thing. It's like if someone else hadn't invented just judicial review, then it would have been invented, because it's pretty obvious that when you have this higher law and you have other laws that contradict it, and you get in the court adjudicating them, something's got to give.
Well, that is all the time we have. Anthony Sanders, the book is Baby Ninth Amendments, How Americans Embraced Unenumerated Rights and Why It Matters. And it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Hold it up loud and proud. And people can get it on Amazon. It's also, tell them where they can get it free as an ebook.
Yeah, you can get it on Amazon. You can buy a copy for yourself. That's great. But if you just want the ebook, you can get it for free on Kindle. You can also get it from University of Michigan Press, the publisher, as a free download.
Best deal you'll get all day, maybe all month. Great speaking with you, Anthony.